from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, there's been a sea change in how we understand and accept gender identity. Last week, the Pentagon lifted its ban on transgender soldiers serving openly, and for over 2 years, Facebook has had more than 50 profile options for gender. But there are few, if any, guidelines for parents of gender nonconforming children, says UCSF psychologist Diane Ehrensaft. She joins us to talk about her new book, The Gender Creative Child: Pathways for Nurturing and Supporting Children Who Live Outside Gender Boxes. That's next on Forum. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Joining us in this second hour of Forum is Diane Ehrensaft. She's Director of Mental Health at UCSF's Child and Adolescent Gender Center and a leading expert in the care of transgender and gender nonconforming kids. Her new book, The Gender Creative Child, is a follow-up to her book published 5 years ago about children who live outside the binary gender boxes of male and female. In The Gender Creative Child, Ehrensaft focuses on how parents and professionals can nurture and support these children whose gender identity is fluid or who question the gender they were assigned at birth. Good morning, Diane Ehrensaft.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. I feel like it would be good to start with just defining what you mean by the gender creative child.
The question about the gender creative child is always the first one everybody asks. What is that? Mm-hmm. So the gender creative child is actually any child. So it's a child who explores gender and is given the space to put together the gender that feels most authentically, quote unquote, me. So I think of it as a mosaic, and I think of the gender creative child as weaving a gender web, each one doing their own one. And I think that our goal is to make room for gender creativity for all children.
So when you say weaving a gender web, I mean, this has been referred to as a gender spectrum, a gender rainbow. You like web. Why is web a fitting description of what the gender creative child is doing?
I want to start out by saying I love rainbow. I love spectrum. But I was thinking that they weren't three-dimensional enough for me. And I was thinking in my own head, gender is a weaving together of nature, nurture, and culture. And that's pretty three-dimensional. So a web really worked for me, if you think of a web in a tree stretching in different directions. So it's the three-dimensional gender web, nature, nurture, and culture. And then it gets into the twilight zone. There's a fourth dimension, and that's time. Because the gender web is not static. We weave, each one of us, our gender webs over the course of our entire lives, and we change them.
So when you say nature, nurture, and culture, so nature meaning our biological sex interwoven with our environment or our environmental cues and learnings, and then culture, and how do you define culture?
I define culture as everything surrounding the immediate caretaking environment. So it would be the community we live with, the religious institutions we're part of, the government that is the government of the country we live in, and we could extend it globally to global culture.
And how does this all – can you give us an example of how these things interact in a particular case? You've mentioned some composite cases in your book, The Gender Creative Child.
Yeah. So let me start out with the nature part, that the biology of gender is still mysterious to all of us. But we are seeing again and again that children are just coming to us. We didn't form it. It's coming from within them. And we are seeing more and more that there is a biology to it, that there is some kernel at birth for some children that leads their brains and their minds. And this is the biology part as well as the chromosomes and their body parts to say either, you guys have it wrong. I'm not the gender you think I am. Or I don't feel comfortable doing gender the way you all say the gender rules are supposed to be. And some of that we find is in the constitution of the child. Parents, schools, any caretaking environment has tremendous influence around how gender evolves. And certainly the concepts of gender and how we understand them spreads out into the culture. And every single culture I've examined has some sense of gender. I've never found yet a genderless culture, but it varies tremendously from one culture to another.
And part of the impetus for the book was that you at your clinic have seen a large growth, right, in the number of kids who are coming there who are weaving this gender web.
We not only have seen a growth, I would call it a tsunami. I just got back from a conference in Amsterdam, International Conference on Gender. World Professional Association for Transgender Health biannual conference. And everybody's response from around the world was the same. When I'd say, how are you doing? Exhausted. Things have just exploded. We can't keep up with the number of families, the number of children, the number of youth who are asking for support.
And this is because you feel like transgender people, people with fluid gender identities have become more visible and accepted in our culture?
I definitely think that. I think we've lifted the lid, whereas many people were hiding under rocks, so to speak. They can now come out into the sunshine and talk about who they are. And we're giving children language to put into words something that children for many generations knew was going on inside them, but they didn't know how to express it. And now they have language.
So when children and families come to your clinic, what are they seeking? What are they asking for in terms of services or support?
When any child and family comes to our clinic, and a child, unless they're over 18, will be coming with their family.
And I should say this is the UCSF Child and Adolescent Gender Center.
Yes, and we are at UCSF Benioff Children's Center in the Department of Pediatrics. And when a family comes to us, they're coming for one primary thing. They want support and helping their children to be healthy, which includes gender health. And they want to figure out how to do that. That's where they start. And usually they come because somewhere a bell went off. There's something going on with my kid and gender. Or the kid rings the bell. Hey, there's something going on with my gender. I'd like some help with that.
And so like a child will say something like, you know, I don't think I'm a boy, or that I don't think I'm the sex that's on my, or I don't think I'm what's written on my birth certificate, or they may come, a parent may be curious about a child who may have a strong affinity, who's a boy, for his sister's dresses or something like that. Are those sort of the types of cues that might prompt them to come and seek out support from you?
Those are perfect examples. And part of it depends how old they are when they show up for their first visit at the clinic. So a family with a 5-year-old will be very different than a family with a 16-year-old.
And how old are the kids? Or do you see a pattern in terms of the age of when they start to come to you, when they start to realize that this about themselves in terms of their gender fluidity?
Here's the pattern I see. It fits within no pattern. That is, I think, as I said before, around that fourth dimension time, it can show up for the first time at any time in a person's life. But with that said, we do see very young children under 5 years old who have already been saying, sometimes with distress, something like this to their parents. You all have it wrong. I'm not the girl you think I am. I'm a boy. Or, why did God make a mistake? I thought God got everything right, but they got it wrong with me. Or, they've been stealing their sibling's clothes, which their sibling clothes represent another gender, and hoarding them in their room so that they can start to send out smoke signals. Hey, look who I am. And so these are some very young kids who are doing this.
We're talking with Diane Ehrensaft, Director of Mental Health at UCSF's Child and Adolescent Gender Center and an expert on transgender and gender nonconforming children. So at what age do you believe that children can truly know their gender identity?
I believe that children can truly know their gender identity as young as 3, 4, 5, or 6. And I will clarify that by saying I was trained as a developmental psychologist. What I learned in school is that all children by the age of 6 should be very clear and know their gender identity. And if they aren't, we should get them to an expert to help them get clear. So my question is, why would this be true? Why could this be true only for children who are not transgender? And why wouldn't it also apply for transgender children to also be very clear about their gender identity by age six?
And I think part of the reason that you're saying it in the way that you are is because this has been a very controversial question, correct, in terms of how young they can be. There have been some who advocate, you know, waiting till the child is entering puberty or something like that before really allowing them to settle on a gender identity.
I would say that can a young child know their gender is one of the most controversial issues, both in the public at large and in the field of gender studies and gender practice as well. So it's a little bit like War of the Worlds right now around that exact question and whether it would be irresponsible to let children change their gender when they're so malleable and young and don't have the mind to be able to really know, or whether we're doing them great harm by saying, sorry, you can't be the gender you know who you are. You're going to have to wait till later.
And of course, you're on the side where that it's important if they're starting to really express a strong sense of their gender identity, that it's important to transition them or socially help them socially transition at a young age. Why is it important to do it at a young age?
It's important to do it at the age where a child knows.
Because
there are many risks if you hold a child back from living in their authentic gender. We know that there's a lot of psychological risks involved for children who are gender nonconforming, transgender. But when we look at those risks, they're correlated with not being able to live in your true gender self. So I would say I've been around for a long time doing clinical psychology, just general clinical practice. I have never seen anything as dramatic as what I call the ex post facto test, that you take a child who's been upset because they think people got it wrong, and then you give them the pathway so people can get it right, and they switch their gender or the way they do their gender, and their happiness quotient goes way up. Their well-being increases dramatically, and the complaining, whining, or terrified child turns into a happy, confident youth.
And when you say they're at risk for – at psychological risk, or there are psychological risks that can occur if a child is not allowed to transition when they feel like they know, which could be at a very young age. What are those? Do you mean like depression or suicidal thoughts, or what are the psychological risks?
The psychological risks for children who go against the gender grain, whether they're allowed to socially transition or not, are as follows. There's higher incidences of anxiety, depression, poor school performance, social anxiety and isolation. As they get older, it gets more serious, where you have kids who start to look suicidal. They may develop an eating disorder. They may get involved in self-harm or in drug abuse, alcohol abuse. And some of them run away from home. That's a lot of risks. And these are correlated with children who are not supported in being able to pursue their authentic gender or gender expression or identity, and also who are given a hard time by people around them. So the problem is out in the culture, not giving room for the kids to comfortably be who they are.
And are there data or studies that have found that if you do allow a child to and support the child in terms of the gender identity that they're expressing at a young age, that they're at less risk for these psychological issues?
We are just beginning to collect data. Mm. And we have to collect a lot more data. And we're putting together a study right now to look at that. Christina Olson at the University of Washington has done a definitive study showing that the children who are allowed to socially transition at a young age are doing just as well as a comparison group of kids their own age who are not socially transitioned transgender children.
We're talking with UCSF developmental and clinical psychologist Diane Ehrensaft, who's worked with transgender children for decades. As transgender people and gender fluidity becomes more visible and accepted, more children feel free to come out and play, as you've put it, Diane Ehrensaft. And I'd like to open the phone lines early to see if we have Folks out there whose child might fit the description that Diane Ehrensaft is suggesting, or if they just have questions, join the conversation by giving us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum at kqed.org, post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can tweet us or you can post your comments also on Facebook. So, Diane Ehrensaft, earlier you said that you've experienced a tsunami of new children and families coming to your clinic. What could you just tell me in numbers what that means? So what were you initially seeing, say, when the clinic opened in 2009, and what are you seeing now?
We were seeing maybe a third of the number of kids we were seeing when we opened in 2011, and I think it's tripled since then in the number of kids we see each year. I don't have the exact numbers, so I don't want to quote numbers that I don't have in front of me.
Okay.
But what I can tell you is that we're swelling and almost bursting at the seams at every one of our clinic visits, trying to accommodate the number of families who would like to see us right now.
And this is a book, The Gender Creative Child, that's designed to help parents and professionals who want to nurture and support their creative child. So what do you see as the most common issues that parents have, or I don't know if there's, you're saying there's such diversity in all of this, of course, but what are some of the things that you see and what are some of the guidelines you like to give parents who are, you know, taking this gender journey with their children?
First, I want to put in a plug for how wonderful the parents are in terms of really being committed to their children and wanting to figure out what's the right thing to do. So what I see at the beginning is, what do we do? We have a child who is telling us something about their gender, like the child who said, look, don't call me he or she, just call me Rainbow Kid. I'm just Rainbow Kid. And often parents start out confused and scared about what's going on for their child. This isn't what they had in mind at the very beginning, perhaps, but how can they do best for their child? So that's where they start. And I would say they also start saying, we want to support our child. The problem is all parents want to support their children, but not all the ways we offer support are actually in our children's best interest.
For example.
So, for example, saying to a child, you know, when you're 18, you can do anything you want, but I'm here to really help you fit in. So if you're a little boy, perhaps my job, let's say as a dad, is I have to teach you how to be a boy. That's my job. So please put away the tutu. Mm. And when you're 18, if you want to wear that tutu, that's fine.
And what kind of an effect does that have on a child to hear a parent say that I'm going to help you fit in?
It almost can be like a death sentence. The last thing the child wants is to fit in. The child wants the opportunity to be themselves. So in going back to the parents, in terms of so we don't deliver death knolls, we start here. Our children's gender is about their dreams, not our dreams for them. Therefore, our job, all of us, all adults, is to listen to what our children are trying to tell us about who they are, not tell them who they are. They will be our teachers, and our job is to be the gender creative adult who can open up pathways for them to feel comfortable being whatever gender they discover that they are and doing it in whatever way they want to. And that's the parent path.
You know, I found it interesting in reading your book that you have a whole section on gender, potential gender categories, and you came up with to try to encapsulate the different experiences of gender nonconformity that children have. So, for example, you have like, you know, kids who describe themselves or who you describe as gender hybrids, gender smoothies. Can you just give us a couple examples of some of these different categories that you've come up with from different composites?
I've had so much fun because it's the kids who have come up with the categories and then I just catalog them. And, you know, we talk about we don't want to put kids in boxes. Aren't these just new boxes?
Yeah.
Kids love labels. They like labels as long as they can rip them off and change them when they want. So this is what I've learned from the kids. So Gender Prius was one of my favorites. And this came from a 7-year-old who came to my office because the parents said that they thought their child had some gender concerns. And when I went out to the waiting room, I saw a little boy looking like a young Steph Curry, dressed completely in a basketball uniform. This young child came into my office. We closed the door. whipped around, and there down the back of this young child was a long blonde braid with a pink bow at the end. Child whipped around again and said, "You see, I'm a Prius." And I looked a little confused. "Yes, I'm a gender Prius. I'm hybrid. I am a boy in the front and a girl in the back." So that would be the gender hybrid. I was telling another child about the gender hybrid because they felt like they were kind of moving from girl towards boy. So I told them about the gender Prius, rather. And this person said to me, "Oh, well, in that case, I think I'm a Tesla. I'm moving towards all electric." So that was another category that grew from the gender Prius.
You know, Ben writes, "How does your guess differentiate between child behavior that's based on regular growing pains versus actual gender identity issues? For instance, a young boy stealing his older sister's dresses might be more of an attempt at emulation than actual gender identity issues."
That is a wonderful question. And I think there is a misconception that gender specialists like myself who operate under what we call the gender affirmative model, which is giving kids a chance to affirm their own genders, is that we just rubber stamp whatever a child shows us or tells us at one point in time. How we differentiate it is by taking the time to listen over many periods of time. So we look for the child who is insistent, consistent, and persistent. So it doesn't just for a month take their sister's dresses, for example, but over a period, maybe 2 years, have been doing this consistently and escalating it to, okay, when we go to Target, I want to go to the girls' section. I don't like the boys' section. I like the girls' section for buying clothes. So we're looking for consistency over time, and sometimes it's an urgency. And so we can say patterns over time. And we're also, we have some indicators. A child who says, "I don't like the body parts I was given. Can we trade them?" That child who consistently says that is a child we're going to pay attention to.
When is medical intervention beneficial? And first, could you describe what kind of medical interventions or hormone therapies, or you've called them puberty blockers and things like that, when is that a beneficial thing to do for a kid? How do you determine that? And what are they?
Yeah, we'll start out with what are they. Yeah. And then for youth, there's essentially three major types of medical intervention that have to do with gender. The one is puberty blockers. Puberty blockers simply turn off the spigot of the hormones that come forward in puberty. So it buys you some time and you stay in a pre-pubertal state while you're on the blockers. Cross-sex hormones provide you with hormones that match your affirmed gender rather than the sex that was assigned on your birth certificate. So those would be cross-sex hormones. And then the last part would be surgeries. And those would be what we call top or bottom surgeries. Later can come facial feminization surgeries, for example. But the main things we know about that some youth under the age of 18 are receiving are top and bottom surgeries.
And when do you determine that a child needs this? And you know what? I think we're going into a break, so why don't we pause for a moment and talk more about that after the break. We're talking with Diane Aronsaf, Director of Mental Health at UCSF's Child and Adolescent Gender Center. She has a new book, The Gender Creative Child, Pathways for Nurturing and Supporting Children Who Live Outside Gender Boxes, which offers guidance and support to parents with children on the gender journey. We'll talk more with Diane Aronsaf and with you, our listeners, after the break. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, and today for Michael Krasny. And we're talking with UCSF developmental and clinical psychologist Diane Aronsaf, who's worked with transgender children and gender nonconforming children for decades. She has a new book, The Gender Creative Child. And before the break, Diane Aronsaf, we were talking about essentially hormone therapy. Can you give us an example of when you used this and why you felt it was beneficial?
So I'll start with puberty blockers. We use it for one of two reasons. One is a child isn't sure. They're still exploring their gender and they need more time. They need more time
before puberty
sets in. And the reason that's important is for many kids who are transgender or wondering if they are, puberty can be a trauma. not necessarily a trauma, but it can be, because suddenly their body is betraying them. What we know about prepubertal children is clothes make the person, that it's very easy to affirm your gender just by changing your hair, changing the clothes you wear, changing your name, changing your pronoun. When you get to puberty, your body betrays you. It starts showing secondary sex characteristics of the sex you don't want to be. So the puberty blockers, just turn that all off. Buy you some more time. That's one reason they're used. And we would give it to a child who needs that time. Once we all collaboratively figure out, okay, that's going to help. The other group of kids are the kids who socially transitioned when they were 5 years old. They've been living for years in their affirmed gender, which does not match the sex assigned on their birth certificate. So this is continuity of care for them. This just helps them move forward just as they were going, knowing that they can then count on what comes next, which is cross-sex hormones. Cross-sex hormones can be given to a youth with or without puberty blockers before, but if you were on puberty blockers, you never went into the puberty that you might not have wanted, and the cross-sex hormones allow you to have the secondary sex characteristics of the gender you know yourself to be. And so you feel much more in sync with yourself, particularly as all the other kids are going through puberty and into adolescence as well. So that's how those two are used. And obviously, we use them carefully. Puberty blockers, completely reversible. You go off them, puberty just kicks in again. Cross-sex hormones are only partially reversible. So we want to be very careful.
Are there side effects to these?
There can be side effects. For some kids, it affects their mood, for example. And for some kids, there's some weight gain. But I would say for the vast majority of kids, if you weigh those side effects against the positive effects of being released from the anxiety, that you're going to end up looking not like a pretty mosaic, but like something that just doesn't fit together well in terms of who you know yourself to be. It's a wonderful boon for those kids.
If someone decides that sex reassignment surgery is right for them, do you have an age that you suggest they wait to do that? Or is there a legal age?
We are, at our clinic, are move away from ages to stages. There are no legal policies, guidelines that say, you know, by law, you have to wait till you're 18. There are certainly standards of care. And typically the standards of care have been that, especially for genital surgeries, wait until 18. But again, these are just guidelines. And the stage theory suggests there are some kids who are ready when they're 16. So it's a question of their readiness that we are seeing more and more kids, not very many, but more and more kids who are receiving surgeries before age 18.
Well, let's hear what our listeners have to say. Kathleen in San Anselmo, good morning.
Good morning. I'm a physical therapist in private practice, and I've seen a few transgender clients, and I'm struck by how what we as healthcare providers don't really provide very well. For example, our medical records programs only have a choice of male or female. We don't even collect data on who this community is, what their risk factors are, what effects their hormones have on their orthopedic health, for example. So I see that we have a long way to go. Are there things being done to help healthcare providers to recognize the needs of this community? And I'll take comments out there.
Thanks, Kathleen.
We do think that's an incredibly important issue to pursue. We have an NIH grant right now with four sites, and we are going to be pursuing exactly that with youth in terms of what are side effects, what about bone health, et cetera.
You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. And let's go next to Suzanne in Novato. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to call in and just confirm. I am a late transitioner. I'm 51, and I recently had SRS and have been transitioning for the last 3 years. But a lot of the issues that your expert were listed for children, I suffered from a lot of those at starting right about puberty. Alcohol and drug abuse, problems with my parents, isolation, all those issues which lasted for a long time until I finally confronted what the issue was. But I grew up in Kentucky in the 70s, and, you know, it was unheard of to, and I think I knew not to say I'm a girl, that, you know, I knew how that would be met. So I just wanted to encourage any parents out there to create the environment where the child could say, I'm facing an issue, or I feel different, you know?
Suzanne, thanks so much for that. And it leads me to ask you, Diane Ehrensaft, how do we keep children safe in communities that are less open to gender creative children than, say, in the Bay Area, immediate surrounding Bay Area?
I would say that safety is always a critical issue for any parent raising a child. We want our child to be the best person they can be. We want them to be safe. So here's what I think about the safety issues. There will be some communities where it is a hostile enough environment that it is not safe to go out in that environment without the risk of getting hurt. In those situations, what I think can happen is parents can deliver to their child the messages, we have a safe space in our house, and you will be able to do whatever you want and be who you are. Sometimes we have to put a cloak around it, kind of like Harry Potter, when we go out in the world, because the world hasn't learned yet. And when people haven't learned and they don't understand, sometimes they're not as nice as they could be, but we're working on it. And that comes to the next point, is we do have to work on it. Mm-hmm. We can't just tell the children we're planning to work on it. We all have to take proactive stances and go out in the community and do education about gender acceptance, gender infinity, gender diversity, gender exploration.
Well, thanks, Suzanne, for sharing your story. Marianne writes, what advice do you have for teachers who encounter gender creative children in their classroom, especially reactions from other children, and how to deal with bullying?
We have a wonderful program in the Bay Area, Gender Spectrum, and it's an organization that develops curriculum for schools for all children, not just the gender creative children. I think it comes to curriculum, that if there's a curriculum for all children, that gender does come in many shades and hues, and that our job is to respect people in all their genders. We're on the way to creating safer environments in schools, and I think it's important in terms of schools not to just respond when you think you've got one that is a transgender child, but that every school should be proactive, just as we have other diversity curriculums, that you make sure you have one on gender as well.
It's interesting, while you give advice for parents to help support their child, you also write about being conscious of parents who might show an unusual enthusiasm for their child's gender nonconformity. What are your concerns when you encounter parents who seem very enthusiastic about their child's gender nonconformity?
My concern is that they might have their own agenda rather than listening to their child. Now, I want to say this is a very small minority of parents. The majority of parents who are very enthusiastic about their children's gender nonconformity are doing exactly what I said before. They're listening to their children. They're suspending their dreams and replacing it to listening to what their children's dreams are for themselves. However, occasionally a parent will want to be politically correct, want to show that they're progressive, and also might get anxious about having a child living in the middle. And so we come back to boxes, that are you a boy or a girl? Which one is it? Oh, well, you must be transgender. Let's do the social transition. When that child's been trying to say, I'm a rainbow kid, I'm a boy, girl, I'm all things, please don't push me into a new box. So it's easier to have a child who's either a boy or a girl than a gender smoothie, which is a child where you throw everything in the blender, press the button, and out comes a gender smoothie. You've got me. So I think that we just want to help parents slow down and just ask, who am I doing this for, myself or my child?
So that's your advice to parents who you are concerned might be needing, you know, the category or some sense of clarity before the child is clear.
Yeah. And usually what I say is, look, we're going to work as a team. I'm a mental health professional. I'm going to tell you what I see. I'm going to tell you what I see through my eyes, learned from listening to what your child is saying from their mind and feelings, and we'll put it all together.
Let's go to Beth in Albany. Hi, Beth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question or observation is that there are other cultures that I have read about around the world that recognize 3, 4, sometimes 5 genders, and that they have a place in society that's recognized, but they don't have to choose between male or female or feel like they have to explain and go into these machinations of different qualities that they make up, but it's a recognized place. So are we not talking about a societal problem in some way?
Beth, thanks. Diane Ehrensaft.
We are definitely talking about a societal issue. I am an eternal optimist. I think we are seeing changes within our own society here in that direction of making room for multiple genders with no disparagement on your character for being something other than male or female, and acknowledging that gender, as I said, comes in many hues, not just 2 colors.
Well, AJ writes, do you know of a case where after a child expresses that they identify as a different gender during pre-adolescence, later in life they return to the gender that corresponds to their sex at birth?
We do know of cases in which people gender transition again. So they may gender transition to something completely different or back to where they started. And we get very nervous about that. It makes us very nervous, and we always hear, well, what if they change their mind? Well, if they change their mind, let's ask in a different way. Just, well, what if they change their mind? Then we help them transition to the gender presently that they feel most comfortable being. Because as I said, it's not static. It's a lifelong process. So we do have some cases, and certainly we have some cases where there has been remorse about partially irreversible or totally irreversible medical interventions, but I want to say they're quite rare.
EJ, thanks for the great question. Do we know the long-term physical consequences, Diane Ehrensaft, of puberty blockers, of cross-sex hormones, their use in the way that you're using them at the clinic, or are you studying that now?
I would say we know quite a bit, and there's a lot more we need to know. So we are absolutely studying it for that reason. For example, puberty blockers were originally used for young children with precocious puberty who might have started puberty at age 3 to stop it until it was a normal age for going into puberty and then going off to puberty blockers. Those people have been followed for many years, and they're doing just fine. So we don't have a lot. We have some data now where it looks like the kids are doing fine. We want more data because this is a fairly new intervention to use puberty blockers for gender affirmation.
Well, I want to go to Joya in Berkeley. Hi, Joya.
Hi. My question has to do with how you talk to people who are cisgendered or don't understand how a person can identify with a gender or be a gender that they're not assigned at birth. I've had a lot of difficulty with this as a cisgender person, and I just want to know how I can be the best ally that I can be and talk to people who sort of don't get it. And I'll take my question off the air.
And Diane Ehrensaft, can you define what cisgender is? Or Joy, if you want to.
Well, cisgender means on the same side as. And what that means is you're okay, you're fine with the sex assigned to you on your birth certificate. And so the gender that matches that sex is the one you live very comfortably with in your life. And that's a cisgender person.
And so what advice do you have for Joya?
The first step, I think, is to spend some time with the transgender child and just get to know them or see some videos about them. I think we have a more difficult time when we don't have familiarity with something. And there are a lot of fear-based assumptions about transgender people that are easily removed when you really get to know somebody and hear their story. And I think that would be a significant first step to becoming an ally.
You know, Sarah has a related question, which is, a few years ago, the 7-year-old child I nannied for socially transitioned from male to female. Since it happened during the summer, we threw a kid-friendly pride party, and I attended the Gender Spectrum Conference with her family. What are some tangible ways other adults in the child's life can support the evolution of a child's gender identity and expression?
There's a really simple mechanism for supporting a child's gender identity and expressions, and it's called mirroring. The easy thing to do is make sure you mirror back to the child who's showing themselves to you rather than the child you want them to be. So children feel really good when you affirm their gender by using the right pronoun, by using the right name if they change their name, by saying you look beautiful today, whatever it might be, to let them know I see you. And I also love you for who you are, or like you for who you are, rather than even that slight glance, which will be bad mirroring, like a distorted funhouse mirror. If you kind of look a little askance, for example, when you see a boy in a dress, that little boy is going to pick that up right away and might either get angry or cringe or hide. And you want to do what I call is take a look at your own gender ghosts, those things inside you that say that's not right, and work on those and let your gender angels take over. And those are the parts of you who say, I can embrace people and all their differences and respect that I may not be them, but they have a right to be them.
Diane Aaron-Saft is Director of Mental Health at UCSF Child and Adolescent Gender Center and an expert on transgender and gender nonconforming kids. You can join the conversation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Felicia in Mountain View. Hi, Felicia.
Hi, I'm a transgender woman. I transitioned and started back in 2001 while I was still in the Air Force. And then I had my face done with a legendary Dr. Alistair Hurt, which cost me an incredible amount of money. You know, transitioning young is really important. And I'll tell you, and people don't understand first, because when you do this when you're older, you have half a life in the old world, so all your documentation and everything's in the old world, and then you've built this career, and then you try and change. I got kicked off an army base. It caused me a lot of problems, even when I tried to explain it to people. The younger soldiers were supportive, but others weren't. Recently, I had a Navy contract job, and through the Navy found out I was transgender. I was kicked off their base. So when you start younger, you get a chance to build your life as who you are, and you don't have to run into as much expense and headaches. And I'm just hoping that this generation and the next generation will have a lot easier than the transition as we were older.
Felicia, thank you. You know, I think Joanna writes, my niece is 7 and dresses as a boy. Her hair is short. She wears exclusively boys' clothes and likes it when people think she is a boy. However, she still identifies as a girl. Any thoughts? Her parents are supporting her and hope it is a phase. Her mom thinks it's because she identifies with her dad so much, so she wants to just look like him. Is this possible? My niece is secure and happy and doesn't seem to be worried about it.
It is always possible that something that a child expresses about their gender is simply a stopping point along the way in their gender journey. But what I will say is when we say it's just a phase, there's a negative connotation because we know that phases in childhood are things we hope kids get over. So when we say, well, it's tantruming, but it's just a phase, they'll get over it. So I would be really careful about language and not using the word phase, but a time in life. So this is a time in life when this is how this child is expressing herself, and she may always express herself that way. I talk about apples as the kids who are transgender and oranges who are the kids who are fine with their gender identity, just like your niece, but they like to express their gender in their own unique way, and that might be a girl dressing in boys' clothes.
You know, at the top, I had mentioned that there's been a sea change in the way that we understand gender identity, and there really, I was surprised to, you know, relearn the fact that, you know, even just as recently as 2012, we were calling gender identity issues a disorder and that language has changed. Can you just tell us quickly, if you could, just how things have changed just in the last 5 years, 5-10 years?
I think things have changed tremendously in the last 5 years. It's one of the reasons I wrote a follow-up book to Gender Born, Gender Made, The Gender Creative Child, because things had changed so much in the last 5 years. I thought I had to start with a new volume because of all the changes. So the biggest change is acceptance. I think we are moving towards understanding and acceptance, and that gender is not a disorder. It is a healthy variation in the human experience. And I think that taking gender identity disorder out of the mental health diagnostic manual was great, but we still have a mental health diagnosis, gender dysphoria, and I would be happy, particularly with young children, to see that one gone too.
What would you like to replace it with?
Nothing.
Hmm. Well, I'd like to get your reaction to Dave, who has some strong concerns. He says, you have no idea the unintended consequences that making decisions that are not the natural order of things will do. You have no long-term research that tells what hormone therapy replacement does. God, move over.
I would say it depends what we call on as natural. It is my experience that what we are helping these children do is in the natural order of things. And I know that this is another area of big controversy. So we'll just have to agree to disagree on that. And indeed, we do have research and we're doing more research. And our biggest commitment is to the gender health of these children and youth. And as we've heard from some of our callers, to the adults who have preceded them, who are also our best teachers, many of whom have said to me, if only I could have had that for me when I was young.
Nancy in Santa Rosa. Hi, Nancy.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I wanted to thank you for addressing the whole issue of overenthusiastic parents, because what I've been seeing up here in Santa Rosa is oftentimes a push back into the binary. And we've got a youth queer group up here for the last 17 years. I've been listening to young people, and we really try to just provide them a space to be without having that identity, so that when they walk in the room, they can just be who they are regardless. And I think the best thing parents can do is to look at the school environment and the community environment and see how we can have the culture embrace young people instead of putting the onus on them to need to accommodate themselves to the culture. And I wanted to thank you for bringing that up.
Nancy, thanks so much for calling in. I guess it all boils down to what you've said in your book, which is to recognize the child you have rather than the one you think you have, Diane Ehrensaft.
I think that's absolutely right. I always use the analogy of Stuart Little, that Mr. and Mrs. Little gave birth to a mouse. They expected to give birth to a human child, and then they went, we have a mouse. I think the same thing happens about our children's gender. We just don't know the moment they are born. But once they're born, we embrace them.
I'm being told that we have a link, by the way, for our listeners to genderspectrum.org, the curriculum resource that you mentioned. Judy in San Jose. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I want to recommend a program that is on. It's a real-life program that is called I Am Jazz, and it is in its second season. It's a family in Florida whose fourth child was born designated a boy, but she knew from the very earliest possible age, certainly by age 3, if not younger, that she was in the wrong body. And her family realized this and knew this and let her finally, by age 5, come out to their friends and family at her birthday party at age 5 and wear a girl's swimsuit.
Yeah. Well, Judy, are you familiar with I Am Jazz, Diane Ehrensaft?
I definitely am, and also with jazz.
What do you think of it?
I think that jazz is one of our spokespeople. And when I said learn about a young person, jazz is a good person to learn from. And the only thing I would say is we often say somebody's in the wrong body. It's actually that they're in the wrong gender. And they may be fine with their body, but the gender feels off to them. So it's not always the body that's at issue. It simply may be their definition and understanding of their self.
Iris in San Francisco. Hi, Iris.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi. Thank you so much for doing this program. It is a really wonderful program to be able to listen to and very prescient for me right now. I have a 16-and-a-half-year-old gender-fluid child, and I have been working really hard to be supportive of my child as they, explore their identity overall in these really transitional years for humans. And I've been, I don't want to say quietly, because it's not like I'm in the closet about my support, but I have been just providing support to my child and being there for them. The events in Orlando, though, and I apologize, I might not be able to make it through this without crying, but the events in Orlando really made me feel like, in order to make the world safe for my child, I have to speak up as much as I can. Mm. And really try to change the conversation that's happening in our society right now. On the other side of that coin is my child's father, who really feels that in order to keep our child safe, we need to be quiet, and we need to tell our child to be quiet and to not talk about who they are. And I'm just needing help with how to navigate this really tricky issue of safety right now. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Iris, thanks so much.
I would say, Iris, that is a very painful situation. I am the mother of a gay grown child. And yes, Orlando hit me very hard. And I would say that at the moment you're at, this is where a mental health professional can be really helpful, particularly when there's a difference of opinion about how to ensure your child's safety. For example, many parents feel that acceptance is the best tool of safety and resilience you can give a child, where other parents feel that's foolish. But if it's between you as a mother and father, I would say having someone you can sit down with to sort that out so you can land on the same page and feel together that you're keeping your child safe would be the best way to go.
Diane Ehrensaft, how big do you think this population is of transgender and gender creative children?
We don't know, because some people are very quiet about it, but the estimates are 1 to 1.5% of the population. I think it's bigger.
Well, Diane Ehrensaft, thanks so much for being with us today.
And thank you so much for having me.
UCSF developmental and clinical psychologist Diane Ehrensaft. Her new book is The Gender Creative Child, which focuses on how parents and professionals can nurture and support children who are gender nonconforming. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Have a great rest of your day.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.